Let's begin with a question that people ask about where the speed up in quantum computation comes from. And if you look at all the literature on this, review articles and so on, some people talk about superposition and entanglement. Some, just about everybody talks about that, but that's a very general name too. But what, in what sense precisely do you get a speed up from superposition and entanglement? All people emphasize that the state space of n bits is a space of 2 to the n states, but the state space of n qubits is a space of 2 to n dimensions. So in a sense, it's a much bigger qubit space. Sort of, there's more room to move around, but you can sort of develop this idea. Then there's a completely different point that you can compute all, the idea of computing all values of a function in a single computational step by quantum, so-called quantum parallelism. I mean, this is emphasized by Deutsch and associated with the many worlds interpretation. Deutsch has long claimed that if you get a quantum computer to work, then that proves the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics is correct, because the only way of explaining how you get the speed up is to assume that all these different computations are going along in parallel in different possible worlds. Or people cite the possibility of an efficient implementation of the discrete quantum Fourier transform, which you'll see is involved in some algorithms, or all of the above. So you see there's some kind of well, I won't say confusion, because I don't think any people who write about this are confused, but very different ideas about where really do you get the speed up from, you know? And I want to present a different picture. I want to say that the salient feature, the essential feature of a quantum computation relative to a classical computation, at least in the period finding and related algorithms, which are the ones I'm going to talk about now, the classical ones, Shor's algorithm, Simon's algorithm, Deutsch's algorithm, is the possibility of crossing information in an OR state, a disjunctive state, you know, this or that, but I mean, with many of this is kind of that, you know, this or this or this or this or this or this, without evaluating the truth or falsity of the disjuncts, the this or the that. That's redundant classical information, you know, which one of the disjuncts is true for a quantum algorithm, but essential information for a classical algorithm. And I'll illustrate that immediately with Deutsch's algorithm. So rather than computing all values of a function at once, the whole point of a quantum computation is precisely to avoid calculating any values at all, in the sense of producing a value in the range of the function for a value in its domain. So let's see how that works out. Okay, this is the first, this is the very first elementary algorithm that I mentioned to you, Deutsch's. It's actually referred to as Deutsch's, actually this one is referred to as Deutsch's XOR problem. And the more generalized version is referred to as Deutsch's problem. So with the elementary version, you're given a Boolean algebra that is 0 and 1. And the XOR problem is that you have a black box or an oracle that computes a function. So it maps 0 and 1 into 0 and 1. And we require to determine whether the function is constant. It takes the same value for both the inputs or balanced. I mean, this terminology, constant balance, was just introduced by Deutsch. So the function either map 0 and 1 onto the same value, both go to 0, or both go to 1. That would be constant. They both go to the same value. Or balanced, which is they go to different values. So 0 goes to 0 and 1 goes to 1, or 0 goes to 1 and 1 goes to 0. The only two possibilities. The only two possibilities for same value or different value. Okay? Now, this is the way it's implemented. You have two registers, an input register and an output register. And you start off with both in the quantum, in the qubit state 0. So these associated with the Hilbert space of two dimensions, one qubit Hilbert space and another qubit Hilbert space. But the tensor product of the two, you start off setting them both to 0. Then you apply a Hadamard transformation to the fifth qubit. That takes, Hadamard transformation takes 0 to 0 plus 1, normalized at root 2, and 1 to 0 minus root 2. So basically, it's a rotation. I mean, this is 0, this is 1, then this is 0 plus 1 over root 2, and this is 0 minus 1 over root 2. So a Hadamard transformation just does that to the base. When I gave this talk at the University of Maryland, somebody said, how do you do Hadamard transformation? I had to say, I have no idea. But I mean, it's a unitary transformation, so there's some way of experimenting to do this. This is still in the state 0. Now you apply a unitary transformation, which implements the black box, the function. That's why I've written U with an F there. So the unitary transformation takes the input state 0 to wherever it takes it, to F0, which is a 1 or a 0. And it takes 1 to, you know, wherever it takes it, 1. I mean, so when the input state is 0 and you apply the unitary transformation, the output state goes to F0. And when you apply the unitary transformation to 1, the output state goes to F1. Now, if F is constant, then the final state is either 0 goes to 0 and 1 goes to 0, that is, they both go to 0. Or if 0 goes to 1 and 1 goes to 1, if they both go to 1. So you end up, you don't know whether the function maps, if it is constant, then the final state is one of these two states, which I label constant 1 and constant 2. You don't know which it is, right? But you know that it's either that state or that state if the function is constant. On the other hand, if the function is balanced, then either 0 goes to 0 and 1 goes to 1, so they go to different values, 0 and 1, or 0 goes to 1 and 1 goes to 0, right? These are the two possibilities for the balanced function. So you know that at the end of the, not the end of the computation, but that when the function has been applied, the unit transformation associated with the function, you're going to get one of these four states. And you have to figure out, you have to design an algorithm which will tell you not which state it is, because you just have to find out whether the function is constant or balanced. So you have to find out whether it's one of these two or one of these two. And so now notice, oh, by the way, I should say that classically, intuitively, it's clear that the only way to find out whether the function is balanced is to run the function with the input 0 and see what the value is, and run the function with the input 1 and see what the value is. Then find out where does the function take 0, where does the function take 1, that's two steps, and then compare the two, see if they're the same or different, right? So you have to run through those steps. There's no way of finding out whether the function is constant or balanced without finding out what the values of the function are. So the point of quantum computation, I want to say, is there is a way of finding out the answer to this global question, I mean, a question about a global property of the function, which you don't have to know. I mean, you aren't asked for the values. You just ask, is it balanced or constant? The point is that a quantum computation, if it works, can do this without giving you the answer to the question, well, what are the values? It can tell you that the values have a certain property, a certain global property. Okay, so these states, C1 and C2, are orthogonal. And if you just look at them, you can see they're orthogonal. And B1 and B2 are orthogonal. But so this is a three-dimensional in a hyperspace, and the constant states are span a plane because they're orthogonal, so they span a plane called the constant plane. So I'm here drawing C1, and C2 would be orthogonal to it, say maybe at right angles to C1 in the plane spanned by these two lines. B1 and B2 are in the span of the plane spanned by these two lines. Okay. But the C states and the B states are not orthogonal, because this plane and this plane intersect in this line. And in fact, if this state is 45 degrees from this line and this line, and this state is 45 degrees from this line and this line, it's easy to see that this angle here is actually 60 degrees. Just Euclidean geometry. So these, the C states and the B states are not orthogonal. Well, you can easily find out what that line is. And that line is just C1 plus C2, because C2 lies in this plane, but at right angles to this back there. And so this line is C1 plus C2 over root 2. Similarly, this line, B2, would be in this plane, but sort of back there. And so this line would be B1 plus B2. And that turns out to be 0, 0 plus 0, 1 plus 1, 0 plus 1, 1, in what's called the computational basis. The computational basis is the basis you start off with some conventional basis. So this 0, 1 basis is the computational basis. So this is a Hadamard basis that you get by transforming the computational basis. So in the computational basis, that's what the intersection is. Okay. Now, if you apply a Hadamard transformation, so I'm not transforming the state, I'm just applying a transformation to the basis, take the basis to this basis, then 0 will go to 0 plus 1 over 2, and 1 will go to 0 minus 1 over 2. I'm just going to call them 0. I'm going to call these states 0 prime. Because we'll need this kind of on basis. So this is 0 prime, and this is 1. Okay? I'm going to put the prime aside. Okay. Now, in the Hadamard basis, this state here, which is 0, 0, plus 0, 1, plus 1, 0, plus 1, 1, is just 0 prime, 0 prime. And that you can always see in your head, because 0 prime is going to 0 plus 1. And this 0 prime is 0 plus 1. So if you multiply 0 plus 1 times 0 plus 1, what it is 0 plus 1, obviously that would be 2, tensor product. 0 plus 1, and that 0, 0 plus 0, 1 plus 1, 0 plus 1, 1, which is what we had before. So this thing here is just 0 prime, 0 prime, and this then is, which would be C1 minus C2, and this here, which is B1 minus B2, this was B1 plus B2 and C1 plus C2, is just 1 prime, 1 prime, and this is 0 prime, 1 prime. So these planes, the constant and the balanced planes, are spanned by these lines, 0 prime, 0 prime, 0 prime, 1 prime, 1 prime, 0 prime. Now, to find out whether F is constant or balanced, we could just measure the observable with these eigenstates. We're in a four-dimensional Hilbert space, so the observable is the observable, you need four orthogonal lines. So these would be the four orthogonal lines, but we know that the constant and balanced states are in this three-dimensional hyperplane spanned by this state, and this state, which is orthogonal to this state in the plane role. But if you just measure this observable, the observable of these eigenstates, then what's going to happen is, let's suppose that's the actual state. Must be one of these four states. So suppose it's this state, and you measure this observable. Then with probability half, it will collapse onto this state. And if it collapses onto this state, then you don't know whether the function is constant or balanced, because it could have been this one. This one could have collapsed into that state. But with probability half, it will fall on this line. And similarly with C2. And the same thing for B1. So with probability half, you will either get this value or that value. And in that case, you know whether the function is constant or balanced. And in the other 50% of the cases, you'll get this value. So, but notice that when you do get this back, then you know that the function is constant, but you don't know whether, how it's constant. You don't know the values. You know, you don't know whether 0 goes to 0 or 1 goes to 0, or 0 goes to 1. Well, you don't know whether they both go to 0 or they both go to 1. You just know that it's in this plane.
Well, you do, don't you? Because if you, so if you have C1, then you know it's C1.
No, no, but if it's C2,
yeah,
which
you
is...
Yeah, you get a negative.
But you don't, you want to tell them to grab the phase there. Yeah. But, okay, now here's something that's important. A Hadamard transformation, remember this, here's a little, something a little confusing, but it's not. These are the actual states, so to speak. I haven't performed any transformation on the state. I mean, initially I performed the Hadamard transformation. So there are two steps so far. The initial Hadamard transformation, the implementation of the function, which correlates the values. And now, and then I didn't do anything else, but say, look, if you consider this basis as opposed to the 0, 0, 0, 1 basis, the unprimed basis, then these planes are characterized in this way. But that's just to refer to, well, if you change your point of view, you know, if you look at it from the perspective of this basis as opposed to that basis. Now I'm actually going to apply a Hadamard transformation, that's the third transformation, to the state, that's the basis, to the actual state, and rotate the state. If you do that, notice that a Hadamard transformation to the final state, actual physical transformation, is the same thing as dropping the primes in the representation for the constant and balanced planes. Because if you apply Hadamard transformation twice, it's the identity, so you get back to where you started. So 0 prime, which you get from 0, 0 by h, if you then apply h to that, you go back to 0 prime. And applying a transformation to the state is the same as just leaving the state alone and transforming the basis. So this is the point I want to make. The relationship between the states, C1, C2, B1, B2, and the constant and balanced planes, the plane, this is the projection operator onto 0 prime, 0 prime, 0 prime, 1 prime, and 0 prime, 0 prime, and 1 prime, 1 prime. I'm just talking about these planes. This plane is characterized by the sum of the projection operator onto this and this, and this plane is characterized by the sum of the projection operator onto this and onto that. So I'm saying the relationship between the actual states and the primed and the planes in the prime basis is the same after you transform the state to HC1, HC2, HB1, and HB2, and the planes defined by the things without the primes. I mean, this is just saying you can keep the state the same and rotate the basis, or you can rotate the basis and keep the state the same. Yeah?
I don't agree with H squared is equal to identity. Isn't it a rotation of 45 degrees in the basis? So wouldn't you have to do like 5?
Yeah, but if you apply, again, the final phase doesn't matter, but if you apply, I mean, let's take 0. 0 goes to 0 plus 1 over root 2. And now, so that's the first h. Now apply another h. Well, 0 goes to... 0, yeah, what's that space, it's a broad band. 0, this 0, under another Hadamard transformation, goes to 0 plus 1. And, and this 1 goes to 0 minus 1. Yeah. So you've got 0 plus 1 over root 2 plus 0 minus 1 over root 2. Over 2, and that's 0. I mean, because this bit's going to cancel, so you have 0 twice. 0 over 2 divided by over 2. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. This goes twice. And then over twice over two. And then over two. So this is two over two, zero over two, zero. Okay. So that means that if you transform, you have a first Hadamard transformation, and then you have a application of the function, and then you have a final Hadamard transformation, where you take C1 and C2, which you derive from the unit transformation, to HC1, HDP, so on. And then that's what it looks like. I mean, it's exactly the same picture, except these are the H's, and these are the original computational places. And the reason for that is that, let me just say for that, it's first, the reason for that is that if you want to compare the speed of a classical, the efficiency of a classical computation and a quantum computation, you want to, it's a little like comparing apples and oranges, because it's a completely different situation in the quantum case. But you want to have some conventional way of counting the number of steps in a quantum computation. So the idea is that all these unity transformations that are involved, they must be implemented with a standard number of elementary gates, unitary gates. So generally, you pick like about two unitary gates, which are maybe practice about four or something. In terms of which, any unitary transformation can be designed, you know, by concatenating them. And then, if you have a unitary transformation like the unitary transformation that implements the function, you have to know how to do it in terms of how many elementary unity gates do I need to apply, which will actually do that. Similarly, if you're considering making a measurement in a certain basis, what that basis is would require a calculation, and that calculation should be considered as the number of steps to compute the basis that you're doing a measurement. If it's not the standard basis, you have to take that into account. So to avoid considering that, you always transform back to the final basis. So this final Hadamard, and then you count the number of steps that will take you back to the final basis. So you can do it with a Hadamard transformation, and then each Hadamard transformation has to be shown that you can implement it in some way with certain elementary gates, and then you count all the steps. Anyway, so you always start off in the computational basis, apply a Hadamard transformation to give you. So the Hadamard transformation, what it does initially is, this is what Deutsch regarded as essential to the quantum computation. The first Hadamard transformation is giving you all possible values, so to speak. You know, I mean, by applying the Hadamard transformation to the zero, you get 0 plus 1. And if this was, if you didn't just have zero, if you have four possible input values, then you'd have 0, 0. Exactly what you could say, 0 4 values, and then you'd have 0 plus 1, 0 plus 1, and say you get 0, 0 plus 0, 1 plus 1, 0 plus 1, 1. So the initial Hadamard transformation gives you a linear superposition of all possible input values. And then you apply the function, so you get a correlation between all possible input values and all possible output values. All possible input values and their associated output values. And then you apply a final Hadamard transformation, or some transformation equivalent to that, to get you back to the computational basis. So that's the structure of the algorithms. Now, I mentioned that has an even probability of failing, but there's an interesting variation by Richard Cleave, who's here. Goes back years when he came up with this idea. And that avoids this feature. And that's interesting, not just as a trick, but because it comes up, interestingly enough, in some of the other algorithms. The idea is just start off with a 1 instead of the theory. Then you apply the Hadamard transformation, that takes this, but you apply the Hadamard transformation to both radiuses. So this 0 goes to 0 plus 1 for the root 2, and this 1, which is the alpha, so it is the alpha radius, there goes to 0 minus 1 over root 2. Now, now this is a little tricky, but it's just, not tricky, it's mathematically sort of, but it's just a matter of, it's just a matter of playing around with these things to see if this is what you get. If you input an x, and x is a 0 or a 1, with this state in the output register, and you apply the unity transformation to the two of them, then the output can be written in this way, where the value of the function is a phase of this minus 1. Now you have to like play around with this to see that's the case, but let's see if we can do it in, I mean, if this is a 0, then you're going to get 0, and you're going to get, well, maybe I should write that. You're going to get, well, you're going to get 0 f0 and then minus 0 f1. Let's just think if this is a 0. Then you're going to get 0, and then when you apply the function, this 0 is going to go to f0. And then you're going to get a minus, and then 0 here. And then what goes in here is 1 plus f0. Because you start, you've got a 1 here, right? So, I mean, see what I'm saying is if I've got a 0, and then I've got a 0 here, so then I apply the function. So the value that I get here is 0. There's a 0 you start off with. And so this thing goes, this thing will take, we'll put in, put an F0 into the output. So I add 0 plus F0, and that's equal to F0, because this F0 is under 0 or 1. So 0 plus 0 is 0, and 0 plus 1 is 1. So this value here, when I apply the function, is just F0. But now I've got 0 times, now what I start with is a 1. But now when I apply the function, I put in the slot an F0, but I've already got a 1 there. You know, it's as if this thing has been set 1 up, so to start off with. So I have to add the 1 to the F0, and this F0 is 0. I mean, this F0 is either 0 or 1. So if it's 0, I end up with 1 plus 0, which is a 1, and if it's 1, I end up with a 0. So notice what I said. I said that if F0 equals 0, then I end up in a slot, just like this way, with 1 plus 0, which is 1. If F0 is equal to 1, then I end up in the slot with 1 plus 1, which is 0. And I end up in the slot, which is 0. So what happens, what goes into this slot is the reverse of the value of the function. If the value of the function is 0, then I end up putting a 1 in that slot. If the value of the function is 1, I end up putting 0 in that slot. And there's a minus sign in front of here. So that's the same, if you think about it, as this. Because that's it. This imagine this is a 0. Then this F0, and imagine F0 is, let's assume F0 is 0. Okay, consider that case. Then minus 1 to the 0 is 1. So if this X is a 0, I'm going to get 0, 0, minus, and this minus 0, 1. I'm going to get 0, 0, minus 0, 1. But if this F is a 1, then I'm going to get minus 1 to the 1, which is minus 1. So I'm going to get minus 1, 1, 0, and then minus one, plus one, let's say, zero, one. So I'm going to flip the order. I mean, maybe I should just write it down, so that, because it's confusing. It's really just a matter of arithmetic, but I mean, that's a crucial step, or crucial, I guess, a crucial realization that Cleve had. So, I mean, suppose you start off with zero, and then I go, what have I got there? I've got zero minus one. Let's leave out the root two, because, you know, it's just a normalization. I've got zero minus one. Under the unity transformation, where is that going to go? Well, let's suppose, starting off with zero, let's suppose that F0 is zero. So zero goes to F, I'll write down F0, minus zero, and then one plus F0. I mean, this is 0 plus F0, that's always the same as 0, 1 plus F0, flip. So this is the energy transformation, will take me to that. If F0 is equal to 0, then this thing equals, I'm going to consider both possibilities, and this thing is equal to 0, 0, minus 0, 1. And if F0 is equal to 1, then this is equal to 0, 1, minus 0, 0. So you see, if it's 0, then it's that. If it's 1, then it's that with a minus sign. Because this is just minus this. It's equal to minus 0, 0, minus 0. Right? So I either get this or I get this. And but that's the same as what's written down here. Let's use that word for here. Minus 1 to the F0. Well, let's just write down that formula. If F0 is equal to 0, then that's minus 1. I'm considering this thing over here. It's minus 1 to the 0, 0, 0. I'm assuming that the thing is 0, right? 0 minus 1. And if F0 is equal to 1, then this is minus 1 to the 1, 0, 0 minus 1. But this is equal to, because minus 1 to 0 is 1, 0, 0, minus 0, 1, which is right here, and this is minus 1, minus 1 to the power 1 is minus 1. So this is equal to minus 0, 0, minus 0, 1, right, which is the same thing as this. So this it is just another way of writing what you get. Now, I've made the calculation with assuming that I'm start off with a zero there. And so now we can do the same thing by starting off with a one there. And you'll see that you get that. So I just put a one there, and I write 1, 0 minus one, and see where you get by UF. I'll have two possibilities. And then I'll consider this way of writing it and see that it's the same thing. So it's a little intuitive maybe, but this is just a way of writing what you do actually get depending on whether the input is 0 or 1 and what the value of f is, excuse me. Now, once you see that, which is just a question of some arithmetic really, then you can consider, well, what happens if I input 0, I'm going to lose, should be there, what happens if I instead of having just a 0 or a 1, I have a 0 plus 1 over 2. And now, now you see that you get this, because if I have a 0, then I'll get minus 1 to the f0, if I have 1, I have minus 1 to the f1, 1, with this on the right. But if you just multiply this out, you'll see that you get the sum of these two things with for 0 plus 1. So again, that's just sort of arithmetic. But the conclusion is that if you apply UF, the unitary transformation, you start off with 0 and 1 here. You apply a hat, the punchline is this. If you start off with a 1 here, and you apply the Hadamard transformation to both registers, and then you apply the unitary transformation, the Hadamard transformation will take this 0 to 0 plus 1, and will take this 1 to 0 minus 1. And if you then apply the unitary transformation, you're going to get something that looks like that, where the value of the function is now a phase of minus 1. Well, it's a phase of the state. So this is an overall phase factor for the state. And notice that if you do that, you've applied the unitary transformation, and surprisingly, you can write the final state with this 0 minus 1 over root 2 in the end. So it seems almost as if when you didn't need this state, because you start off with 0 minus 1 here, and then you apply the unitary transformation, and then you get 0 minus 1 here in the end. So maybe you could just sort of forget about the state. But that's just, that's not correct, because the unitary transformation is correlating input states and output states. And the fact that you can then write the final state with this as a factor, the same factor as you start out with, doesn't mean that. That's just sort of a mathematical fluke, in a sense. It doesn't mean that this is these have not become correlated. If you did not consider the state, well, then you wouldn't get any of this. So you have to consider the state, even though it looks like it's not playing any role, because it starts off with this, and after the transformation, it still is. But that's just because of the nature of the correlations that you can write. But the interesting point is that you start off with a 0 and 1, and you apply the unitary transformation after the Hadamard transformation, you get that as the final state. That is, this is in the same state as it was in the beginning, and this has now become written in this form. Of course, you could write this in various other forms. It's just that you can write this in that interesting form, where you could think of it simply this way, that when you apply the Hadamard transformation to this composite state, it ends up where you leave this alone, and instead, in front of the 0 and 1, you put these phase factors. I mean, but that's just, it's not the case somehow that you don't need this, because this unitary transformation is entangling the 0 and the 0 and the 0 and the 1. It's just that when you write it all out, you can write it out in that way.
And UF on the tensor product space is supposed to implement what is called quantum parallelism.
No, it's not the UF which is implementing quantum parallelism. The UF is just what's implementing the quantum parallelism is the Hadamard transformation, which is taking 0 to 0 plus 1. These are the two possible input values. And then the unit transformation is giving you the output value for the input value 0 and the output value for the input value 1. I mean, you get 0, f0, and 1, f1.
It's only that. It's putting that on the superposition.
They're just doing it on the superposition.
That's my fault.
Oh, I see. That's my fault. Yeah, okay. Oh, yes. Yes, the f is. Okay, I understand what you're saying here. Yeah, that's correct. The f is, so to speak, giving you the function value on a whole linear superposition in one state. That's where the quantum parallelism comes in. Yeah, right. So then you go to that, and then now So now you just consider the two possible values, the two possible two possibilities for f that can be constant or balanced. And now, if it's constant, that is f0 is f1, the final state is this, because you know, the f0 is now the f1. So f0 and f1 are either both 0, in which case these numbers are both plus 1, or they're both 1, in which case these numbers are both minus 1. And so you end up with a plus or a minus 0 plus 1. And if f0 is not equal to f1, then you end up with a minus sign there, because these numbers are different. I mean, either this is 0 and this is 1, or this is 1 and this is 0. So that will mean that either this is plus or this is minus, or this is minus and that's plus. So you end up either with 0 plus 1 in the input, or 0 minus 1 in the input, and these states are orthogonal. So you can determine it by measuring. So that is, instead, here's the actually, this is not quite right, because what this would be is, this would be correct if these were primes, the Hadamard, or it would also be correct if you need this in a computational basis and put HB1 and HC2 and so on. But the point is, it's the same diagram. Instead of the constant and the balanced states, instead of the two constant states being two orthogonal states in this plane, and the two balanced states being orthogonal in this state, the effect of having a 1 in the output register is that the two balanced states just both lie along this line. You know, they're plus or minus this line. And the two constant states just are plus or minus along this line. And so they're the same state after an overall phase. And now by measuring, you're either going to get this state or that state. This is indeed, you will never get this state. Okay, so note that, because this is useful for later, if you start off with 1 as the initial state in the output register, then the effect of this thing is that if f is constant, then it does nothing. There's nothing to well, if f is constant, it just leaves you as u plus 1 over root 2. I mean, that's what you started out. That's what you had before, u plus 1 over root 2. And if f0 is not equal to f1, then it amounts to, from a geometric point of view, to a reflection of the state 0 plus 1 over root 2 of the input register. A reflection, I mean, it takes this state to 0 minus 1 over root 2. So that geometrically is a, it takes this state to this state, and geometrically it's a reflection in this line here. And this line is orthogonal to this line here. So what you really have is that either, if you put a 1 here, then the unitary transformation geometrically either does nothing in this case, or it reflects the state of the input register in the line orthogonal to 1. I mean, if you start with a 1, it's going to reflect the state in the line orthogonal to 1, which is the 0. That is, 0 plus 1 is going to go to 0 minus 1. Now, I put it this way because you can generalize this to a kind of geometric rule, which is actually what's going on in the Grover algorithm. Okay, now, in general, if you have a function which is mapping a whole product of Boolean algebras, which would be strings of zeros and ones, into 0 and 1. So if you map n-bit sequences into 0 and 1, and they all go to the same value, 0, except 1, then if you have some input psi here with a 0 and 1, minus 1 in the output register, and you apply this unitary transformation here, then they all go to 0 except 1, which goes to 1. then this amounts to just reflecting the state in the hyperplane orthogonal to the one which is mapped onto onto one. Because this is just a generalization. I mean, if you apply this, if I consider sort of the geometric significance of the previous result, where I just had a b here, if I consider a bn, in the case of b, they all went to zero except one went to one, but there were only two of them. But if they all go to zero except one, some unknown one which is probably x zero, then if you put a minus here and you apply the unitary transformation, which would take, so this is now a string of zeros and ones, and each string goes to zero, one of them goes to one, then this must be geometrically the same as just reflecting this thing here. This thing, this that here denotes reflection in the hyperplane orthogonal to x0. So if you want to do a reflection in the hyperplane orthogonal to x0, you just put a 1 here and you apply the unitary transformation. So what I'm saying can be really thought of in this way. From the previous, as a generalization of the previous point, I'm saying this, that if you have a box which implements the unitary transformation, and I have an input and an output, and I set this thing to zero, this thing to zero, then I'm going to have this zero, that's the input, and the output is going to be, zero plus x zero, which is f zero. But if I make this 1 and I input 0, then, or actually, let me just put an x. That's what I would say. Then this goes to fx, and I'm starting off with 0. This is fx. See, if I have an x here as the input and the output is zero, then the input will be the unit transformation x does this x zero to x fx, which is really zero plus fx, which is fx. So that's what this box is doing. But if I put a 1 here, then that's equivalent to zero and I x zero. Let's say this is I x zero zero. That's equivalent to leaving this a one and I'm writing this wrong. I'm confusing. What I want to say is that this thing here with the 1 here is equivalent to, how do I write this? I want to say I could convert a box which makes the unitary transformation to reflection by just putting a 1 here. You know, what it does is it just amounts to reflecting this 0. This ix0 means reflect in the hyperplane orthogonal to x0. Okay. I don't need that right now, but it's useful to know for the Grover's algorithm. Okay, let's just consider the generalization of Deutsch's algorithm, what's called Deutsch's problem, and that's determine whether a Boolean function is constant or whether it's balanced, where it's promised, say now I've got strings of zeros and ones, it's either constant or balanced. And balance means that the function takes the value 0 and 1 an equal number of times, right? So there are 2 to the n strings of zeros and ones, and half of them go to 0 and half of them go to 1. Otherwise, they all go to 0, all go to 1. So now you can write down, so now you have an input register which is a sequence of zeros and ones, and if I start off with this in the state one, then you can, and apply the unitary transformation, then this is the same as a sum where each of these terms in this linear superposition here gets a phase, fx, as a generalization of what went on before. And if you apply the Hadamard transformation, I don't want to go through this now because it's delayed too much. But if you apply it, you can see that just as I showed that the unit transformation amounts to putting an fx there, the Hadamard transformation amounts to putting an x dot y in front of the fx. Maybe I could just say y. Well, what this means is the bitwise inner product of x and y. So if I have x as some sequence, say let's take a sequence of 0, 1, 1, and y is 1, 0, 1, let's say, then the bitwise product is, tensor product, is I multiply 0 by 1, I get 0, plus 1 times 0, which is also 0, plus 1 times 1, which is 1, so that's 1. So 0, 1, 1, dot 1, 0, 1 is 1. And so in that case, for that y and that x, this would be minus 1 to the 1, which would be just minus 1. But I have to add whatever this thing is. So I'm summing over all x's and y's because I start off with sequences of zeros and ones. And in order, if I finally have my transformation to a sequence of zeros and ones, like 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, then this goes to 0 plus 1, and this goes to 0 minus 1, and this goes to 0 plus 1, and so on. And so I have a string of zeros and ones with pluses and minuses at various places. And this way of writing it just keeps the plus and minuses, keeps track of the plus and minuses. The way to see this is just to consider the case where I just have 0, 0 to start with. And then, then just work it through with 0, 0 here, and then see that you can write it down in this way. That's the simplest way to see that this is just a general formula. Anyway, take the case n equals 2, which I have, which is what I said. Now you've got a 2 here, so you get 0, 0, plus 0, 1, plus 1, 0, plus 1, 1, when you apply the Hadamard transformation, and the 1 goes to 0, minus 1. And after the unity transformation, the state is going to be plus or minus 0, 0, plus. I'm just going to get the same thing with a plus or minus. If it's balanced, I'm going to get pluses and minuses here, which are determined by this formula here. But what you know is if it's balanced, two of them are plus and two of them are minus. Right? But which two is you don't know. And there are obviously three different ways I could get this. I mean, if I ignore an overall phase, I mean, I could get these two plus and these two minus, or this one plus and these two minus, and so on. And there are going to be six different possibilities, but they'll come in pairs with a plus or minus in front of them. So there are three orthogonal balanced states, because every one of these balanced states is orthogonal to every other balanced state, and also orthogonal to this state, because I have two pluses and two minuses. So if I take the scalar product under this state, the plus and minuses will cancel. So any one of these states with two pluses and two minuses is orthogonal to this. So I have four states which are orthogonal. And after a final Hadamard transformation, the state of the input register is there. Just go back here. This is 0, 0 plus 0, 1 plus 1, 0 plus 1, 1. If I apply a Hadamard transformation to that, I just get 0, 0. If I apply a Hadamard transformation to the other ones, I'm just going to get, you can see, 0, 1, or 1, 0, or 1, 1. So after the final Hadamard transformation, I either have that state, if it's constant, or one of these states. And clearly, in order to find out whether the state is constant or balanced, I just measure the computational basis. And if I get that state, it's constant. And if I don't get that state, then it's balanced. So that's the short, the Deutsch algorithm, two algorithms, the very elementary one and then the generalized one for sequences. And with the Klee variation, you can do the generalized one exponentially faster than you can do the classical one, because if you have to figure out whether for n length sequences, whether it's balanced or constant, you have to take a number of input values and actually calculate the output value and then compare it. And that will require an exponentially increasing number of steps. Whereas with the quantum computation, you don't need an exponentially increasing number of steps. It is, however, that's a bit artificial because, as someone pointed out to me when I gave this talk, there you could do a randomized classical algorithm and offer a certain number of steps, you would be able to guess the right answer in a number of steps, which is a polynomial function of the input. So there's a practical advantage. You wouldn't, I mean, you could use classical computers if you were actually faced with that as a practical problem to do things. Classically, you can have algorithms which will compute the function with the function and solution. Mm-hmm. Or you can have what are called randomized algorithms where to the fact there's a step in the algorithm where there's a choice made, like it's tossing a die, and then you get an answer which sort of is a random function of the input. But you can show that for randomized classical algorithms, you sometimes get, in the long run, so to speak. Well, I mean, over an average, you are more, you have a better chance of getting a solution to the problem in a polynomial number of steps than with a randomized. So it turns out that this is stuff about classical computation, which is not really relevant to the quantum. What I want to show, and maybe this is the most interesting part of the talk, is that Simon's problem, which is the problem of finding a period of the function, actually reduces Deutsch's problem. Now what is this problem? Well, you now have a Boolean function, so it's mapping strings of zeros and ones onto strings of zeros and ones. And it's going to map it onto, it's periodic, so it's going to map it onto the same value. I mean, if xi is the same as xj, if and only if xi, if j is xi plus r for some period. And since when you add r plus r, you get back to where you were, the function is 2 plus 1. So I'm going to take simple examples so you can see exactly what's going on. This is the point. Since the function is periodic, the possible outputs of f, the values of f for the different inputs, partition the set of input values into mutually exclusive and collectively exhaustive subsets, and these depend on the period. So to find the period really just amounts to finding those subsets. Let me show you that with a particular example. Take n equals 2. So now I have an input state 0, 0. I'm going to go to output states, which are also strings. So how many different possible values of the period are there? Well, you can have a period 0, 1, or 1, 0, or 1, 1. 0, 0 isn't the period, right? Because when you add 0, 0, you don't change anything. So let's take the period 0, 1. Well, that means 0, 0 goes somewhere, has some value. And if I add 0, 1 to 0, 0, that goes to the same value. So 0, 0 and 0, 1 go to the same value. But if I add 0, 1 again, I get back to 0, 0, because 0, 0 plus 0, 1 is 0, 1. And 0, 1 plus 0, 1. The 0 goes to the 0, and the 1 plus 1 goes to the 0. So I get back to 0, 0. That's what I had before, where I said that when you add the period twice, you get back to where you were. So the other possible values are 1, 0. And if I add the period 0, 1 to 1, 0, 1, 0 plus 0, 1 is 1, 1. So these two values go to the same, are mapped onto the same value by the function, if it's periodic with period 0, 1, and these two are mapped onto the same value. So that's what I meant by saying the function is a 2-to-1 function. I mean, two values go to one. But if it's 1-0, the same thing, but it's just a different partition. See, this is a part. The period is associated with a partition of the input values into two mutually exclusive, in this case, and collectively exhaustive subsets. So it divides all the input values into this set and this set. If it's 1-0, it divides the input values into this one and so on. Because 0-0 plus 1-0 is 1-0, 0-1 plus 1-0 is 1-1. Now, start out with finding Hadamard transformation, so you get the input state as 0-0 plus 0-1 plus 1-0 plus 1-1, apply the UF, so you get 0-0 F 0-0 plus 0-1 F 0-1, but F 0-1 is the same as F 0-0, so I just write F 0-0, and then plus 1-0 F 1-0 plus 1-1 F 1-1, but F 1-1 is the same as F 1-0, so right like that. And similarly for the other periods. And now you can see that that reduces to the same geometric construction as Deutsch's XOR algorithm, because if you look here, you see you've got here zero plus 1-0 for this case, and 0-1 plus 1-1. So in Deutsch's algorithm, we had 0 goes to 0, and 1 goes to 0, and 0 goes to 1, or 1 goes to 1. All 0 and 1 go to different values. So 1 goes to 0, and now 1 goes to 1, or they go to 1, 0. Now, I mean, it has the same form as Deutsch's algorithm with an additional case here. So what does it look like geometrically? You get now three orthogonal planes in the four-dimensional Hilbert space. This plane, which was the before the constant plane, and is now associated with the period 1-0. You just go back to see 1-0. The period 1-0, you get 0-0 plus 1-0, 0-1 plus 1-1, which were the constant states. And for this, you get these two. These were the balanced states before. So this constant plane is now going to be associated with the two, let me go back and say it's precisely. You end up with this state. If you now imagine measuring the output register, right? I mean, you're either going to get F0, and let's say that's the period, just pick this one. You're either going to get for the output register F0-0 or F0-1, whatever the state is. That means the input register will be left in this state or this state, right? So if that's the period, the inputs, and you measure the output register, then the input register will be left in this state or this state. If that's the period, the input will be left in this state or this state, and if that's the period, in the state or this state. But if the period is, if the input register is left in this state or this state, that's the same as the previous case where we had two constant states, and if it's left in this state or this state, that's the case for the balanced case before. So if you imagine measuring the output register, you're going to get two orthogonal states in this plane, if that's a period. If that's a period, you're going to get two orthogonal states in this plane, and in the other case, you're going to get two orthogonal periods in a plane that I'm representing here, but it's orthogonal to the other two because it's spanned by this and this, which is orthogonal to this and that. So I have now three orthogonal planes in this four-dimensional space, each of which is associated with a different period. And just as in Deutsch's algorithm, the final Hadamard transformation amounts to dropping the primes, and that allows the plane corresponding to the period to be identified by measurement in a computational basis, except when the state of the register is projected up to 0-0. So just as in Deutsch's algorithm without the Klee variation, if you you know, you end up with a state which is either in this plane or in this plane, one of two states, orthogonal states, this plane or in this plane or in this plane. You measure the input register, and then either you get this value or this value or this value, in which case you know what the period is. If you get this value, that's the period. If you get this value, that's the period. If you get this value, that's the period. But the state might collapse onto this, in which, and that'll happen half the time, then you don't know. So, because I just want to mention that, yeah, then you don't know. I can go back here. So, in the formulation of the algorithm in the literature, they say you have to repeat it. So you run the whole algorithm again, and then until you get an outcome which is non-zero-zero. But because there are three possibilities of getting something non-zero-zero, eventually you're going to get one of these other possibilities. So, and overall, you're exponentially faster than a classical, even without even variation. I just want to say, I mentioned that you measure the output register, which leaves the input register in a certain state. But you don't have to actually measure the output register. The fact is that the input register will be in, the reduced state of the input register will be in one of those states. It's going to be a mixture of those two states. And so it's not that you have to actually measure the output register, it's just that pedagogically, conceptually, it's easier to imagine what's going on. So, well, if I were to measure the output register, the input state would be one of these two states, and now I can tell what the input state is by measuring the input register. So you really just have to measure the input register and not the output register. So now what happens, just to see the general case, if you take n equal 3? Now there are 7 possible periods, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, and so on. And now, if it's, let's just take this period, 0, 0, 1. The state of the two registers now goes to 0, 0, 0 plus 0, 0, 1, if 0, 0, because if 0, 0, 1 is the same as if 0, 0, plus, now, take this other value, 0, 1, 0, add 0, 0, 1, you get this. So these two go to the same value, these two, so again, it's 2 plus 1. You map these two values onto the same value. These two onto the same, these two onto the same, these two onto the same. If you were to measure the output register, then the input register would be left at this state, or this state, or this state, or this state. But even without measuring the output register, it's some mixture of these states that you have if you're just considering the output register. Now, these states can be written in the Hadamard basis like this. You just work it out. I mean, you rewrite this. This is 0 plus 1, 0 plus 1, 0 plus 1, plus 0 plus 1, 0 plus 1, 0 minus 1. You add things up, comes to things cancel, you get this. So it's easier to see what's going on if you look at these, although this might look more complicated, because these are, each state is a linear superposition of this, 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 and this with different pluses and minuses. Apply a Hadamard transformation, it amounts to dropping the primes. So you really get these in the computational basis without the primes. So that means if the period is 0, 0, 1, the state of the input register ends up in the four-dimensional subspace spanned by these states. And the same for the others. If you work it out, you find that of all these other possible periods, the final state is one of these subspaces. So the bottom line here is that the thing to hold on to, because I realize this is kind of technical, the thing to hold on to is that you want to find out a period which is a global property of the function, or whether the function is constant balanced in the previous case. These properties, constant balanced, period is 0, 0, 1. They associate with subspaces. The state ends up in one of these subspaces. To find out what the subspace is, you can make a measurement and maybe with a certain probability find out which subspace the system is in, and then you know the global property, period so and so, or constant versus balance. You don't know what the values of the function. You just get the answer to your question without computing the values of the function. So in this case, you have to, can you find out what the period is? Well, you notice that they all span by this state. These are four-dimensional subspaces which intersect in planes. In the Deutsch case, they were planes which intersect in lines, in a line. Here you have four-dimensional subspaces which intersect in planes. How can you see that? Well, take these two. They intersect in this line and this line. So, and they're orthogonal, so they span a plane. So these two four-dimensional subspaces in the 2 times 2 times 2 dimensional Hilbert space intersect in the plane spanned by 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0. Take any other two, you see the same thing. Take these two, well, they intersect in, this, in the plane spanned by this and this. So now you have to make a number of measurements because to distinguish which plane it is, you have to get an answer which is not in the intersection, in the overlap region in the plane. And you can see that you just want two values. You just have to get two values different from 0, 0, 0. I mean, if you get 0, 0, 0, you don't know. But if you get, let's say, 1, 0, 0, then it could be this one, or this one, or this one. Those are the only ones with 1, 0, 0. But then if you get another value, let's say 0, 1, 0, then you know it's this one. Because there's no other one that has 1, 0, 0 and 0, 1, 0. So you need just two values. And that will, two values distinct from 0, 0, 0. So you run the algorithm until you get two values distinct from 0, 0, 0, and then you have the answer.
So we don't project onto the subspace, but rather repeatedly project onto eigenvalues and then associate different eigenvalues that are common in the subspace.
I'm not sure what you said. The final state will either be a linear superposition of these states, or a linear superposition of these states, or a linear superposition. So the final state will either be in this plane, or not, in this hyperplane, hyperplane, and so on. And you just have to find out what it is. So you just measure in the computational basis until you get two values different from 0, 0, 0, and it gives you this state. It gives you this.
So the measurement result itself will be an eigenvector within one of the subspaces?
Yes, the measurement result will be 0, 1, 0.
Okay. Yeah. And so here to need to determine the subspace, you need two elements.
You need two elements different from 0, 0, 0.
And therefore, yeah. It has to repeat.
Yeah. But very, when you look at, if you look at Simon's algorithm in a textbook, say, or some book which discusses it, you will find that they say, they don't talk about subspaces or anything like this. This is my own formulation of what's happening. They have the algorithm written down algebraically in a general case, not in any, something for n values. And then they say you just have to find two values, yi, which will be a sequence of zeros and ones, for which yi dot r is equal to zero. That is the bitwise inner product of yi and the period is equal to zero. And you don't know the period, you can't find out the period. But if you find, so they say, run the algorithm until you get two values of yi, and they will be two values such that yi dot r is equal to zero. Now, I couldn't figure out initially why, I mean, well, algebraically you can see why, but it didn't intuitively, so I couldn't intuitively see what was going on. But if you see it here, that's exactly what's going on here. You want two values, yi, the sequence of zeros, three, of 0 and 1, such that that sequence of values all its...
But two values is only in the n equals 3 case, right?
Yeah, two values in the n equals 3 case.
Yeah, if you would have n minus 1 values.
That's right. But you want the string of values, let's just say x, y, z, so three numbers, such that x, y, z dot the period is equal to 0. Now, let's see if that really works out. Well, let's suppose the period is 0, 0, 1. So you want three numbers here such that x times 0 plus y times 0 plus z times 1 is equal to 0. Well, those are going to be any of these guys, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, see? Because 1, 1, 0 times 0, 0, 1 is going to be 0, 1, 0, 0 times 0, 0, 1 is going to be 0, and 0, 1, 0 times 0, 1, 0 is going to be 0. So you need two values in this case, satisfying the condition that, as they put it, I am just index of the value, dot r is equal to 0. And you see that that's exactly, you see the reason why I don't make it.
Isn't there some type of cleat modification to that?
You get it automatically
without having to run the algorithm in the meantime?
Yes, there is, apparently. I was talking to Richard Peel about this, and I actually didn't know this. And he said, well, there's a Klee variation for this as well. But I suppose he wrote something. This is the way, if you look up Nielsen and Chuang, which is the Bible of this field, the book by Nielsen and Chuang, then they discuss the algorithm as a randomized algorithm. Maybe in the end of the chapter, they something which says there's a variation, but they don't actually do it. Okay, now, what are we at? 12, okay. Well, I'll sort of run through this kind of fairly quickly, as also with a simple example. You take the big algorithm, which is Shor's factorization algorithm, which is important because factorization is the basis of RSA cryptography. So, so if you could break the RSA factorization algorithm, then you, everything, I mean, all, you could directly foundation, say, okay. But this is a little bit of just number theory, which I've mentioned is behind it. To factorize a number n that's part of the two primes can be shown by number theory and results to reduce to the problem of finding the period of a function a to the x mod n. For any a less than n, which is co-prime to n, that is, has no common factor. So you know n, and you have to find the two factors. So you just choose a number a, which is less than n, and which has no common factors with n, you know n. And then you find the period of the function a to the x mod n, and that will enable you to factorize it by a certain rule. Let me just give you an example rather than consider the general case. Take the case n equals 15. So the factors are 5 and 3. And choose a equals 7, which is co-prime of 15. And then you work out f to the x, which is 7 to x mod 15. And you choose a range of values which is just suitable so that you can see the period. So I take 64 because everything works out nicely. So starting at 0 and 63. So work out 7 to the 0 mod 15, 7 to the 1 mod 15. You get 1, 7, 4, 13, and then it starts repeating. And you can just see the period is 4. This repeats up to 4. The number theoretic algorithm says you get the factors by taking a, which is 7, to the period, which you worked out, which is 4. 4 over 2 is 2. So you take 7 to the 2, which is 49, minus 1 and plus 1. So you get 48 and 50. And you take and you find the greatest common factors of 48 and 15, which is your original number, and 50 and 50, and that comes to 3 and 5. So that's how you do it. And this bit here is just part of the number theoretic algorithm. Once you have the period, the way you get the factors is to take this number a to the power r over 2 minus 1 and plus 1, and work out the common factors of this and this and 15. Your n. So you take a to the r over 2 minus 1, a to the r over 2 plus 1, find the common factors of this number, and n. And those will be the factors of the greatest common factor. Those will be the factors of the number n. That's just number theory. Okay, so let's see how it works out quantum mechanically. After the unitary transformation, now there's a unitary transformation which is implementing the function a to the x mod n. the state of the registers, I mean, there's an input register and output register. So 0 is going to go to 1. I mean, that's from working out before. If you have 1, 7, 4, 13, you know, this might be quickly. 0 went to 1, 1 went to 7, 2 goes to 4. These are your x values. This is the output. You get 1, 7, 4, 13, and so on. So that's what you get here. If you have value 0 for the input register, it goes to 1, 1, 7, 2, 4, 3, 13, and then it repeats. And there's 64 terms here, so that's why I've got a factor of 1 over 8, because that's the square root of 64. And now you can write that as just collect all the input terms which go with 1 and all the input terms go with 7. You write it like that. And now, if we measure the output register, then you get one of these states for the input register, 0, one of these states for the input register, 048, blah, blah, 159, 2610, and so on. That's these states here. Depending on the outcome, either whether you get 1, 7, 4, 13, you'll get these four states. Now, some of it complicated, but again, this just let me explain what it is. You now apply a discrete quantum Fourier transform for the integers mod 64. This is the analog of the Hadamard transformation. So what this is doing is taking you back to the computational basis. I mean, you've got here, all these elements, and the sum of them, you have applied a final Hadamard transformation, which was basically just taking you back to the computational basis. That's what it's doing here. But in this case, you need a Fourier transform. And mathematically, a Hadamard transformation is just a Fourier transform for the integers mod 2. Now, I haven't actually written down what the Hadamard transformation is, or what the Fourier transform is, but what it will do is it will take a state like this to a state. Well, I mean, in fact, this is the Fourier transform. It will take you from this state to a state like that. Let's see what these numbers are. Well, here my S is 64, because I had, that was the, the X values went up from 0 to 64. And my period was 4. And so this is what the, then I'm summing up over, this is 0 plus. These terms here, xi plus jr, xi is this or this or this or this, and then I just sum 1r, 2r, 3r, 4r, right? And r is 4, so 0 plus 1r is 4, 0 plus 2r is 8, 0 plus 3r. So this is just the general form of those terms that I had. And if I apply this discrete Fourier transform, I end up with this exponential term over here, and it looks like that. And if I actually work this out, I'm going to end up, instead of having all these states here, they will be transformed to a linear superposition of 0, 16, 32, and 48, and for all the different values of what's called the offset, this, 0, 1, 2, 3, I'm going to get this state, or that state. So this is just like the Simon algorithm, where I ended up with, it's the analog of this step here. Just go back to this step. It's the analog of this step here, where I have some states here, and I apply a Hadamard transformation. It's the analog of sort of taking, of getting these states without the primes, of transforming the final state. So where am I here? So for the period r equal 4, the state of the input register ends up in the four-dimensional subspace spanned by these states, 0, 16, 32, and 48. Now I have to, as in Simon's algorithm, consider all possible periods for this function, where a is cofactor 4. Well, now I have to consider the other possible values of a. Well, they have to be values of A which are that have no common factors with 15. So it's 2, I chose initially A equals 7. You choose A equals 2, 4, 8, 11, 13, 14, and work out the periods. It comes 4, 2, 4, 2, 4, 2. So there are only 2 periods possible for all possible values of A, a period 2 and a period 4. The different values of A with the same period, like 2 has a period 4, 4 has a period 2, 8 has a period 4, so 2 and 8 and, what is it, 13, they all have a period 4. That's not going to change anything except the labels. So if you take the period 2 equals 4, you go back here, if you take the period, if you take A equals 7 and the period is 4, then you get values 1, 7, 4, 13. If you take a different value of A for the same period, all that's going to change are these numbers here. But it's the same period, so you're going to get some number, different number, different number with a different A value, but you're going to just get repeating 4 numbers. So these are just labels here, which in the quantum algorithm are just in the output register. And the only important thing is that you just get 4 different numbers, 4 different labels. What they are is irrelevant. So the whole analysis will be exactly the same. You'll just get different labels here instead of these things. So different values of A for the same period are irrelevant to the algorithm. So we only have to consider R equals 2. Now you'll find that if you measure the output register, you get these two states, and then you apply the discrete Fourier transformation, and you get that for the final state ends up in the subspace spanned by this state and this state. Well, if we go back to the period 4, you see that you ended up in the four-dimensional subspace spanned by 0, 16, 32, and 48. If the period is R equals 2, you end up in the subspace spanned by 0 and 32, which is completely inside this thing. So with the Simon algorithm, you have this, the final state ends up in subspaces which are, say, 4 dimensions overlapping in 2-dimensional planes. So you have a chance of finding a value outside the intersection. But here, if the period is R equals 2, then you're going to be in the subspace spanned by 0 and 32, but that's the same subspace as for the period R equals 4. So how do you ever find the period R equals 4? So this is what I say here. In this case, the 2-dimensional subspace spanned by 0 and 32 is included in the 4-dimensional subspace spanned by 0, 16, 32. This should have the slash up. This is 48. A measurement can distinguish R equal 4 from R equal 2, whether the final input state is in the subspace R equal 4 or R equal 2, only if the final state ends up in outside R equal 2, the part orthogonal to R equal 2. What if it ends up in this subspace? Well, the whole point is that the algorithm works as a randomized algorithm, and if you look at the description of the algorithm, then what you're supposed to do is run the algorithm, get a candidate value for R. So you just make a measurement and you have an A value, and then you find out an answer, and that will give you a value for R. But if you get a value in here, it could equivalently be associated with an R value for 4 or for 2. So you get a value that depends on the value of A that you started out with, and then you just test it by dividing it, by trying to work out the periods. And if you get the right answer, then you're done. If you get the wrong answer, then you do it again. And it can be shown that you'll only have to do a polynomial number of steps before you get the right answer. So, to make this clear, a measurement of the input register in a computational basis will give you a value which is KS over R. You're going to get some value which is term, some number times 64 divided by R, which is 16. You know, you're going to get a value there, so some number, which is, sorry. You're going to get some number which is the multiple of 16. Okay, but okay, what I want to say is, the value of k is just depends on the value of the measurement of the output register, and you repeat the algorithm until you get a value. That's what the description of literature tells you to do, to get a value of k co-prime to r, in which case canceling this, the lowest term, this will give you k over r, and what you want is that that's got a period. So putting it geometrically, if the period is 2 and the value of k is 1, you get the same state, 32, as the value of k equals 2 for r equals 4. So if you get 32, you don't know whether it's r equals 2 or r equals 4. But suppose you get r equals 2 by canceling 32 over 64, the lowest term, so you get 2. And you calculate the factors of n by taking a to the r over 2 plus or minus 1 of n and dividing and so on. If a is 7, these will be incorrect. You won't get the right answer. Because if you take 7 to the 2 over 2 plus or minus 1 of n, you won't get the right answer. But if a equals 2, then that will be correct. So you just do this as many times as required to get an answer. But the essential point is that you're exploiting, in effect, the non-Boolean logic represented by the subspace property, subspace structure of Hilbert space, to get a global property of a function, such as a period or a disjunctive property, same values or different values in the Deutsch algorithm, which you can then efficiently distinguish from alternative possibilities, alternative periods, say, by a possibly a sequence of measurements that gives you the position that you want. Now, I don't know I should try to sum up here. The question is it always work that way in all quantum algorithms? So far, the point is what's going on here, and it seems to be going on in these quantum algorithms, is that they have a global property of a function. You associate that with a subspace. There are alternative global properties associated with alternative subspaces. You can find out in a sequence of measurements which subspace is the right subspace without finding out any actual values. And that seems to be the trick. So the question is, does it always work this way? Well, actually, no. It doesn't work this way with Grover's search algorithm, which is an algorithm for searching a database for some odd item, or also for something which is very much a global property of a function, like a parity. Let me just say something about the parity, because Grover's algorithm turns out to be a special case of a parity algorithm. So how would you, suppose you've got a Boolean function which maps sequences of zeros and ones onto 0, 1, 0, 1. And you define the parity as minus 1 to the value of the function. So for example, if I am you're mapping onto 0, 1, this is just another way of talking. I mean, I want to keep to Boolean functions. So what I've got is sequences 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0. I'm going to map this to 0, all 1. And I want to define the parity of the function as, if there are even or odd number of 1s. And that function is basically saying that if I have an even number of 1s, and this is 1, if I have an odd number of 1s, it's minus 1.
So this type of question couldn't be answered by a randomized algorithm possibly, could it?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, as far as I know. But classically, by the way, clearly because the parity could just, I mean, you have to know all the values because the parity could just change by the last value. I mean, they could always zero if one and the last one is one. So, okay, so can a quantum algorithm do better? Take the n equals 2 case, just to have something precise. So like Deutsch's problem, then, you've got one, where you have one constant state and three balanced states. In the n equals 2 case, you have one constant state and three balanced states. Where the balanced states had, you know, two pluses and two minuses, you can also consider unbalanced states. In this case, these would be the parity one states. That is, a state with one minus and three pluses, or one plus and three minuses, which would just be, you know, the minus case of one plus and three minuses. So, with three pluses and one minus, you get a state which is the unbalanced state after the application of Unity transformation. And the constant and balanced states have parity 1, and the unbalanced states have parity minus 1. So the problem could be thought of as, well, in this particular case, the 82 case, how do I distinguish the unbalanced states from the balanced states? Well, let's see what I'm going to say here. Just go back to this thing. It's clear that the constant and the balance, the constant state was orthogonal to the three balanced states, and this is a four-dimensional Hilbert space for the input register. The unbalanced states with one minus and three pluses, say, they're not orthogonal states. Just think about them. For one minus, three minus, they're not going to cancel if you take a scalar product. And they're not orthogonal to the constant balanced states. So really the picture is, in a four-dimensional Hilbert space, you've got four orthogonal lines for the constant states, 0, 0, you know, 0, 1, and so on, in the prime basis. And then the unbalanced states are just four other states which are not orthogonal in the same Hilbert space, right? So how do you distinguish them? I mean, you can't distinguish them by measure. They're can't distinguish non-orthogonal states from orthogonal states. So what do you do? Well, the answer to the question what you do is you do a trick which really is like a variation of Klee variation. The Klee variation I mentioned right before amounts to a reflection in the plane if you start off with an output state and one. So what you do is you would, in effect, do something, I'll show you a specific case, where you apply a transformation which is going to take the non-orthogonal states, the unbalanced states, the parity one states, and map them all onto one state. And then take the parity zero states, the parity plus one in this convention, and map them all onto an orthogonal state. So you have all these states, but you don't make a measurement to see which subspace you're in. What you do is you apply some trick by reflections and so on, which take all of these states to a particular state, and all of these states to an orthogonal state. And then you just see what you've got. So all of these orthogonal states, the balanced states, the constant one, get mapped onto something. And all of the unbalanced states get mapped onto another state by this sequence of transformations. So let me just say, after the application UF, the state of the input register can be written this way with these phase factors of, because of, as I mentioned before, going through a little calculation. To find the parity, what you do is, and this is to, in effect, this rotation, you know, or transformation where you end up with orthogonal states, you apply the transformation VUF twice, where V is just a permutation. Now, what the idea is really this, it's you're Let me just say, because it's not really apparent, it's kind of like here. You have, let me just go back here. You end up with 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, with pluses and minuses here, right? And what plus and minuses are going to can be written in this way. So there's a plus or minus, a plus or minus, a plus or minus. Now, the plus or minus that is here is going to depend on what the function is. In a general case, you the permutation we're talking about here, the V map, is going to map this one to this one, and this one to this one, and this one to this one, and this one to this one. In the general case, if I had a whole bunch of terms, let me say if I had to write them down like this, instead of four terms, I had a whole lot, let's say 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. What I do, the permutation I apply is this, like I divide this up into the first half and the second half, and I map this one to this one, this one to this one, this one to this one, and this one to the beginning one. And this like this, and this like that. And I do it again. Now, if you think about what happens, think about what's going on here. The first application of UF puts some pluses or minuses depending on, well, you know, whether that term gets a plus or minus. Now, if I map this thing onto this one, and then apply the integer transformation, I've already got, let's say I've got a plus here, a minus and a plus, let's say, for my first run of UF. Now if I apply the unity transformation, if I apply the V function permutation, then this one, let's say it's a 0, 0, gets mapped onto 0, 1, and this one goes over here. So let's look at what happens here. This has a minus sign in front of it. Now I've got a 0, 1 here. Now I've got a 0, 0 here. Sorry, because 0, 0 got mapped onto 0, 1. There was a minus 1 here already. This has a plus, this thing. This thing goes here. Now I have to apply the unity transformation, but now 0, 0 gets a certain plus or a minus, the same as it has here, the same value that the function gives to it. So I start with a minus sign here, and then I apply, this is minus 1 to the f. What I had here before was minus sign, this was 0, 1, so what I had here in this slot here was minus 1 to the f 0, 1. But then when I move, when I apply the permutation, I get a 0, 0 here at the second step and apply the unity transformation to that, I'll end up with another minus 1 to f 0, 0. And then when I do it again, I'll get a minus 1 to the f, this will be the other two, I'll get f 1, 0. And then when I do it again, I'll get minus 1 to the f 1, 1. Whatever these four terms are, you just make it.
Right, so you apply so
footnote. I apply a footnote. Let's just call this 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I mean, what I'll get here, so minus 1 to the F1, that's right, minus 1 to the F2, minus 1 to the F3, minus 1 to the F4 for the first half. And every single term will be multiplied by the same number. And the second half, every single term will be multiplied by the same number. So in this case, I just have 2, so all I'll do is flip that. But after applying this twice, the state of the input register will be the first two terms get multiplied by this, F00 and F01, and the second two terms get multiplied by F0, F10 and F11. Both of them get multiplied by that. Now, you can see that if I take half the terms and the other half the terms, if the parity is plus 1, then these have the same sign. If the parity is minus 1, then one would be then the sign is 3. So I either get with a plus or minus outside, which is irrelevant, a plus in the middle of these two terms, or I get a minus. and these meet that reducible thoughtful. So in two runs of the algorithm, in this case, instead of four runs classically, I will be able to figure out the character. So classically, if I've got four terms, I have to do four runs of the algorithm, four steps. In this case, I cut it down to two, and you can show that you can't get anything better than it. N over 2 speed up. If there are n values, then you can get that speed up, which is not regarded as a speed up, because it's the same order of magnitude. So there's no improvement. And you can actually prove there's a result in the literature that says this is the best you can do in quantum computation. It's not just that this way, but this is the optimal way of doing it. You cannot get any better for this global project. So first, the point I want to make is here you've got a global property, which is parity of function. You would think that you could associate it with a subspace and, you know, get some kind of speed up or improve the efficiency, but you can't. So first of all, you can't always get a speed up in efficiency. So it's only some global properties that you'll be able to get a speed up for. And I mean, it's an interesting question. Well, which can you classify the global properties in some way, where we, as those which you can get a speed up, and you know, an exponential speed up.
Don't you get a speed up there?
Well, the speed up is you cut the time down, you cut the number of steps in half. So yeah, that is a speed up, but that's the same order of magnitude.
Don't classically, don't you have to do 2 to the power of n?
Well, this n I'm just counting as this n is 2 to the n. I mean, 2 to the little n. I mean, yes, two, but this n is just 1, 2, 3, 4. I mean, I've I've changed my labeling, really. But I mean, n is 2 to the n, so n over 2 is equal to 2 to the n minus 1. Mm-hmm. You know, so you just go from 2 to the n to 2 to the n minus 1. Just cut it down to half the number of steps. And that's the best you can do. I should sort of stop, I suppose, but I'll just say quickly what happens here. Grover's search algorithm is you've got strings which go to 0 and 1, and you promise or told that they're all 0 except for 1, which is x0, and you'll be fine with 0. Well, this is like the... like the parity algorithm, in the sense that you can get parity minus 1 for, in the general case, for, you know, all sorts of strings where there are more minuses and pluses, you know, an odd number of ones. But the case where you have all zeros and just one, those are parity minus 1 functions, so there's a special parity minus 1. So the problem is, in effect, like the parity problem, except that you told, I've got a function, the parity is minus 1, and you know that, you told that, and it's minus 1 in a special way. It's minus 1 because everything is 0, it's just 1. So if you told that, can you find what the function, you know, what the, which value gets the 1? Well, let me just say this quickly. You start off with the string of zeros. You apply the Hadamard transformation. You start off with this in the state 1. Then you end up with unity transformation, which produces this, which I had before. And that amounts, that can be thought of geometrically as a reflection of this state here. Because that's where you end up. But ending up here amounts to reflection in the hyperplane orthogonal to x0. Why? Well, just look at it very simply. This is a linear superposition of all x's with pluses. What's the difference between this and this? This state here is the same. Because this fx is 0 everywhere except one value, all the zeros are just, this just gives you plus 1. So you have exactly the same as this. I mean, you have a string of pluses except one minus. Well, that's like reflection in the, just take a minus. If I've got, you know, 1 plus 2 plus, because later different, plus 4 or something. And then I go 1 minus 2 plus 3 plus 4. What I've done is I've reflected this in the hyperplane. I've just put a minus sign in front of the 2 coordinate. Well, that's just the same as reflecting in the hyperplane or far from 2, because I've just got all these the same, and then I've made a reflection of that one coordinate. So this amounts to a reflection in the hyperplane orthogonal to x0. And that's equivalent to applying this transformation, the identity minus 2x. Because if I put an x0 here, and then I just get a minus x, twice x0, so the plus goes to the minus. So this Cleave variation, in this particular case, where you have all the f0 and one of them 1, amounts to this transformation. It's equivalent to that transformation. So now you write this string of all linear, of all possibilities that you get by the Hadamard transformation. And I'm calling it W. And I'm just writing N for simplicity instead of 2 to the N. So I've got to think of this as some string of numbers from 0 to N, or from 1 to N, all with pluses. And then I apply this reflection, and that's the same as sticking a minus sign onto one of them. And notice that if I put a minus sign in front of this, so this is reflection in the hyperplane orthogonal to x0, this is a reflection in the hyperplane orthogonal to this. If I put a minus here, that turns out to be the same as just reflecting in the hyperplane orthogonal to this thing, where this is orthogonal, just because I just have a set of pluses, I just flip my pluses and minuses. So W perf is orthogonal to W, in the plane spanned by W and x0. That means that this thing is going to be a rotation through 2 beta, where beta is the angle between this and this. Because if you reflect, and then you reflect, if I make a reflection in 2 lines, W perf and x0, I've got this line, so this is x0, and this is W perf. And I've got some state here. And I reflect in this line, and I end up here. And then I reflect in this line, so I end up here. That turns out, as you can easily see geometrically, I'm not going to waste time doing it, it's just Euclidean geometry. It's the same as rotating through twice this angle. So this thing is just a rotation through twice an angle. So take the case n equal 2, and suppose that x0, that value which gets a minus 1, is 1, 1. N equal 2, I've got 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. And I'm calling that 1, 2, 3, 4 in that notation. So 1, 1 would be 4. So say the value that gets a minus 1 is 4. After the state of the input register, I end up with, after the Hadamard transformation, the state of the input register is this with all 1s, which I'm calling, but it should be 1, 2, 3, 4. And now I apply this reflection by just putting the output register in the state 1. So I get 1, that should be 2, 3, minus 4. And then I apply this thing, W. And if you work it out, you're just going to get 4. I mean, what is this I, W, perf? Well, it's just 1, just identity minus twice W, perf, W, perf. And you just apply that. You know what W is. You just apply that transformation to this, work it out, and all the coefficients of these go to 0, and this one goes to plus 1. And so you start off with, after this transformation, which is UF with the output register and state that, you end up with the minus there. And then if you apply this IW, or the minus sign in front of it, you can work this out simply this way. You have this state here, and then you apply I minus 2 W. And so we just write that here, you know, 1 plus 2 plus 3 minus 4. You work out these scale products, you know what W is. It's a linear superposition of 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4. And you'll see that you'll get everything goes to 0 except 4. So what you've done is you've taken the state 1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 and rotated it to 4. Without knowing what 4 is, because the rotation is performed with the unitary transformation UF, this state in the state 1, and then the state W, which you do know, which is the linear superposition of all possible states. So in general, what you do is, you remember like in the case of the parity problem, I applied VUF a whole bunch of times, and this was a permutation. And now in the Grover algorithm, you apply IW, IX0 a number of times. In this case, you just have to do it twice. But in the general case, if you have a long string, you can show that you have to do it root n times. And so the angle between W, this linear superposition, and X naught is such that the cosine of the angle is 1 over root n, because that's 1 over root n. You know, the cosine of the angle between this and this, whatever x naught is 1 over root n. And if n is large, then n is very big, so this number is practically 0, so that means that the angle is practically a right angle. So the angle between, the angle beta between W perp and x naught is given by sine beta, which is 1 over root n. So beta, and so the sine of this angle is very small, so this angle is approximately this. So we need about, if you want to rotate W to x0, then you need about root n iterations of the rotation through this angle twice beta, which is about 1 over root n, to move this to that. So in the general case, you just apply this that many times, and you rotate that to that through the angle of 1 over root n. In my example before, I just had to apply that rotation twice to get. First, you start off with this plus this plus this plus to the plus, then you get a minus, then you apply that to get a 4, and you're done. So then in the general case, you won't actually get the state or get something close to that state. But you'd be able to tell what the state is by measuring. Because you can measure in a computational basis and with very high if this is not 4, but a very small coefficients here, and this is very big, which is what you get in the general case, and you make a measurement in a computational basis, which is now 1 plus 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, you'll get 4 with very high probability. You need to get 4 with probability 1. So this is a different sort of algorithm, which involves rotation. And it's not clear whether this is really genuinely a quantum algorithm. Because if you think about it, what actually is going on here, what you're doing is you're taking, you end up with trying to find out, well, you know, is it this state or one of the other states? That's all. That's always what you're trying to do. And what you're getting the answer by performing a sequence of unitary transformations, which amounts to just rotating the state in a certain way. Well, you could apparently do the same thing with just mapping the problem onto classical waves. I mean, there's nothing particularly quantum about this, apparently. I mean, I'm told, but I can sort of see that that it really is a different sort of problem. So here's the conjecture, which is.
Like classically, the average time it would take would be n over 2 if you found the real theory of root n. So there is a big difference.
Well, this is something that I actually am confused about. I was unclear about. When I gave this talk to the University of Maryland, and it was to a group called the Joint Quantum Institute. So this is this quantum information group, so that the people there know what they're talking about. apparently there's some literature which, there's some conflict in literature which I don't actually know the answer to. I thought that this may be incorrect, that Grover proved that so maybe that's what's wrong. I mean, what Grover proved was that to get a root n, speed up, and that this is the best you can do. But what's not clear to me is whether you can get a square root of n speed up classically if you map this problem onto some wave function thing. Because this is what was suggested in the answers to in the question period after I gave this talk, that you can actually get a square root of n speed up with the search algorithm classically if you simply do the algorithm as a classical algorithm with some systems involving where you exploit wave motion to perform this. Now, there must be some literature on this, unless it's just some thought in someone's mind. So, I mean, here's something that you might wonder, if you're interested, you could try and seek this out. So the conjecture, which remains a conjecture at this point in my mind anyway, is this really a feature of quantum mechanics that's being exploited to get this root in, or is there some way in which this particular algorithm, the search algorithm, can really be seen as not particularly quantum after all, and something that can be achieved classically? And if that's the case, then the previous analysis of quantum algorithms having to do with deciding which subspace you're in perhaps is a general analysis, in which case this raises the question about looking at quantum algorithms from that perspective, trying to see if I could see some general principle which would characterize which global properties can be determined with that more efficiently by a quantum algorithm, classical algorithm. So my intuition is, but I don't actually have a way of showing this precisely, but my intuition is that there's something about this search algorithm and the technique that's employed, which is not really fundamentally quantum, in the sense of quantum algorithm. That may be just that may be incorrect, or may be correct. And so this is something that I personally need to straighten out, or want to straighten out. Okay, well, I guess it's 10 to 1, I should stop there. I did want to end up, but we sort of ended up here, I guess, at the end of talking about quantum computation with some sort of general remarks about the foundational significance of all this. I actually started off the first lecture by talking about that, and so let me. What should I say? It's sort of like two sentences or something. Well, the core foundational problem in quantum mechanics is the measurement problem, the problem associated with measurement. What I meant by, from a foundational perspective, with regard to these questions, it's something like this, that if you can see quantum mechanics from an information theory standpoint, that is that quantum theory should be looked at, it makes sense to look at quantum theory as something like a generalization of classical information theory. Then the whole question of the measurement problem of what's being becomes transformed, I think. But maybe that's sort of like a longer story. So anyway, I guess there is sort of a general line of investigation into these foundational questions, which says there's all this interesting, there are all these interesting results in quantum information. We seem to shed new light on the structure of quantum mechanics as far as it's different from classical mechanics. And this essentially comes out of the debate about balancing equality and entanglement. I mean, if you think about the whole debate about what is the meaning of quantum mechanics, the foundational debate about quantum mechanics, going back to Einstein versus Bohr, what they were arguing about was how to understand quantum mechanics. And one could say that, look, what do you mean? What really do you want from the concept of this very general question? As Deutsch, not Deutsch, Wheeler put it, fundamental question is why the quantum? Why? So one way of understanding the question is to consider whether one can come up with certain fundamental principles, which seem natural, which would distinguish a quantum world from a classical world. And the second aspect of this question, puzzled about quantum mechanics, is whether you can see from that framework the measure of problem in a new light. So for example, just to make clear what I mean, Richard Feynman has a famous quote, which everybody quotes, which says something like this, nobody understands quantum mechanics, quote unquote. For Richard Feynman. When relativity, special relativity came out, people immediately saw the significance of this. But in the case of quantum mechanics, there's some fundamental puzzle, if I say that. And Feynman says that nobody understands quantum mechanics in the sense in which people do understand special relativity. So now special relativity is also a rather puzzling theory where you have to change your notions of space and time. But why is special relativity for Feynman conceptually clear, the transition from classical to relativity, whereas in the case of quantum mechanics, it's not. So, what was involved in special relativity? Well, the salient principle which motivated Einstein to make the move from classical to relativistic physics was the light constant. The discovery, this is surprising relative to classical physics, that the velocity of light is independent of the velocity of the source. It doesn't make any sense to say that the velocity of anything is independent of the velocity of the source if you accept Galilean relativity and the classical idea of what you mean by space and time, which goes back to a classical notion of absolute simultaneity. So, as Einstein saw it, if you're going to take as a fundamental principle about our world the fact that the velocity of light is independent of the velocity of the source, then you have to change your whole idea about what you mean by simultaneous, and there can no longer be an absolute notion of simultaneity, that the events are happening at the same time. This notion of same time has to be relativized to state of motion, which means that you have to rethink what you mean by spatial and temporal measurements, and it follows from that analysis of Einstein that you get time dilation and length contraction from the perspective of different initial frames which are moving relative to each other. So that principle, fundamental principle of the light postulate, immediately makes a break with classical physics with respect to what you mean by space and time. And once you revise your notions of space and time, then you doesn't lead to the whole special relativity, but you know, plus some other assumptions, you get the mathematical theory of special relativity. So presumably what Feynman meant by saying that we understand relativity is that we understand what Einstein did faced with the light constant. An alternative to what Einstein did would be Lorentz's. Lorentz, his theory of the electron, where Lorentz said, in effect, look, this postulate, the light postulate that describes the apparent behavior of light, is not actually fundamental. It just seems to be the case that this is so. What's really happening is you've got ether, you've got light moving through the ether, and you've got, because of the peculiarity of motion through the ether with regard to to bodies moving through the ether, which are held together by electromagnetic forces and other similar forces, that things actually shrink, rather shrink as they move through the ether and so on. So what's happening is because physical systems are undergoing dynamical changes, we have the same notion of simultaneity, the absolute notion of simultaneity, the same notion of space and time as Newton. We don't change that.
But even
You can get away with the ether.
You can have the same space and time, but you don't need the ether.
You can get away, that's true. But I mean, I'm just saying what Lorentz said. So anyway, the thing is that you have a dynamical explanation for length contraction and time dilation. And that's to be a different approach to the discovery about velocity of light. But that all seems sort of straightforward. So you can take Lorentz's view, or you can take Einstein's view. But the salient principle is this light principle. It's because light is funny, you know, in that sense. So presumably, to understand quantum mechanics in a similar sense would be to come up with certain principles where you can see the transition from classical quantum mechanics in a similar way. And I think you get these principles from quantum information. And I think that there is now kind of enough evidence in the literature that the fundamental principle which distinguishes quantum from classical physics in the same way as the light principle, the analog light principle, is the Noclonian principle. The fact is that for classical theories, clone information. For quantum theories, you quant, and that doesn't characterize quantum versus classical, it really just characterizes classical versus non-classical. You then need sort of further other principles, it's not quite clear what you want, in order to distinguish quantum from other non-classical theories, maybe super-quantum correlations and so on, which are possible, which one can characterize. But once you see quantum mechanics in that light, then you see that, well, you have to understand what has to change if you take Noclonian as the fundamental and surprising discovery, like the light gospel as a fundamental surprising discovery. Then just as with the light gospel, you see you have to change your mind about what you thought space and time was, or what you mean by spatial and temporal measurements. And you can either take Lorentz's view or some similar view out of ether, which says, look, there's a dynamical explanation for this. Or you can say, no, we have to really change our whole idea of simultaneity, which is Einstein's view. Similarly, quantum mechanics, you have to consider, well, what is Noclonian? What do we have to give up if we accept that Noclonian is a fundamental principle? Well, there's a very close association between cloning and measurement. If you can measure in the sense of identifier, then you can clone. Because if you can identify what you're looking at, then you can compare. If you have a device which can really measure, then you can simply use that device to create whatever you mistake that you've measured, so you can copy, in a sense. And if you can copy unrestrictedly, then you can measure. You can measure in the sense of distinguish. So, once you say no cloning is a fundamental principle, then you have to change your view about what you mean by measurement. And if you follow this line of reasoning, then this leads to something that you can say about the measurement problem. That really it is a problem which is like the problem of explaining why rods contract when they're moving through the ether. And there are two approaches. One is to say, look, we really have changed what we mean by simultaneity, to relativize the notion, and then the problem goes away. Another way of getting the problem to go away is Lorentz's view, which is there's a dynamical explanation and so on. Similarly, in the case of quantum mechanics, I think that hidden variable theories, or theories which attempt to solve a measurement problem, really amount to dynamical explanations for the problem. An alternative approach is to say, no, look, there's something more fundamental going on. It's not that you, in principle, can clone, which you can with hidden variable theory, but there's some dynamical reason about why you can't, associated with the hidden variable theory, with the fact that in the early universe, you could clone, but now the hidden variables have reached equilibrium, and in equilibrium theory you can't clone, and so on. So there's a dynamical explanation for all that. So that solution to the measurement problem really amounts from a different perspective to a dynamical explanation for this principle of no cloning. And if you take, if you say, no, look, this principle really is a fundamental principle about the way the world is put together, so to speak. It's not just a contingent fact which depends on hidden variables that have reached equilibrium and so on, then you have to change, you have to say something different about what you mean by a measure. Because we do make measurements, so you have to say what you mean by measurement. And then I think it'll lead to an information theory interpretation of quantum mechanics. So that's what I meant by the foundational significance of all this. The elevation of taking certain principles in the information theory, in quantum information, like no cloning, and maybe certain other principles, like no bit commitment, and taking these as fundamental principles which characterize our universe, and asking for the significance of that in the same sense that one asks for the significance of the principles that underlie relativity theory. Okay, that was kind of like a rapid 10-minute ending. So I guess we should stop there because it's already 1 o'clock. Do you want me to send you these transparencies, which are a little different?